Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish.
Welcome back to another edition of the Global Development Primer podcast. We're here in person at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia with Mike Lake, who is a six-term Conservative Member of Parliament for Edmonton and Wetaskiwin, first elected in 2006. In both 2019 and 2021, he received the highest vote total of any federal candidate for any party in Canada. Now, Mike served for 8 years as Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Industry and was appointed to the Queen's Privy Council in 2012. He served as Shadow Minister for Youth, Sport and Accessibility, International Development and Mental Health, Addictions and Suicide Prevention. Now, prior to entering federal politics, Mike worked for 10 years with the Edmonton Oilers Hockey Club, where he served as a National Accounts Manager, Director of Ticket Sales and Group Sales Manager. Mike holds a Bachelor of Commerce with distinction from the University of Alberta. Now, Mike has two adult children, his son Jaden and daughter Jenna. And the Lakes have been active supporters of autism organizations, families, and neurodiverse individuals across the country and around the world. So while sharing their own personal story of their life with Jaden, who has autism. And today, Mike Lake is here at Dalhousie University. He just gave a fantastic lecture to the Introduction to Psychology course here, and he's joining us on the Global Development Primer podcast to talk about his work with autism, inclusive education, and a bunch of other great stuff. Mike, welcome to Dalhousie.
It's great to be here.
It's great that we can actually record this one in person. Most of our recordings are in the Zoomiverse, and it's great to see you.
Yeah, it's always nice to see people face-to-face, isn't it?
So, yeah, absolutely. And you just had a sold-out audience, I guess, of more than 300 people here in this classroom talking about your work with autism. Could you bring us up to speed on what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that early in my time as a member of parliament, it's been 18 years that I've been serving, but early in my time realized that there was a real need and opportunity to share Jaden's story, my son's story a little bit, and that services across the country weren't the same as they were in Alberta. And so we started sharing a little bit more and including Jaden and a little bit more of what we were doing. And it's grown to be a really important part of our work over time and a really, something that we really enjoy using the platform for because we see that impact on a daily basis. And so getting a chance to come out and speak to students like we did this morning, we did two classes back to back in that
professors don't even do that. You're a machine.
And it was great, but you have to remember which stories you told in the first class because you don't want to tell the same story twice in the second one. But great reception. And it's always encouraging to see people's response to some of the stories that we're telling.
Right on. So what is Jaden's story? From what I saw, many of the students really, really gripped onto this. They were very curious to know about his personal experiences, your role as a father sort of helping him through it. But what is his story, if you could summarize?
Yeah, well, for context, in the presentation, we show six videos that all include Jaden. So we're kind of walking through a period of Jaden's life in high school. He's 28 years old now. What some would say nonverbal, although I would say he's verbal. It's most of his communications is ba 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 ba, but there's meaning behind some of that sometimes in terms of the way he communicates. But he uses an iPhone or he'll write, and that's part of the challenge with autism is trying to understand exactly what it is that Jaden wants to communicate. Jaden was included in a regular classroom all the way through school. He went to a K-12 school, so went with the same kids throughout school, had an aide, one-on-one aide with him to enable him to work through his schooling. The story we tell broadly is just about inclusion and the impact it had, not just on him, but on the other students that he went to school with. And, by including him in things like musical theater and taking that time to challenge him and stretch him in things that you might not think that would be in his wheelhouse or skill set, you also learn more about him and learn where his skills and unique skills and abilities lie. And We sort of walk through from sort of what we say from inclusion to contribution, right? Mm-hmm. How do you move from inclusion to people realizing, oh, this person has skills and assets, abilities that we maybe didn't realize, that we maybe underestimated. And it's kind of about unlocking potential, because everybody has a contribution to make. But sometimes it takes a little bit more work to kind of understand what that contribution might be.
One of the things you said today I found very important was that there's sometimes attempts to, was it draw kind of Jaden into another world?
Yeah.
And then there was sort of a shift where you brought yourself into his world more.
Absolutely. You know, when Jaden was 2.5, he was diagnosed. And in those early days, before he was even diagnosed, but around that time, mm-hmm. We made the mistake. One of the biggest signs is that Jaden wasn't connecting with us in the way that you might expect a child to connect with you, a toddler to connect with you, right? He was oftentimes playing with, as we said, in his own world. He was playing, stacking up whatever toy he was playing with, generally lining them up, then messing them up, stacking them up, then knocking them over, and then restacking them up, pots and cups and bowls and those kind of things. But he wouldn't interact in the way that a child might take a car and pretend to drive it and then watch you while you pretend to drive the toy car as well. Mm-hmm. And kind of have that, what I think they call joint attention, right? That kind of play. It was just very different with Jaden. And we did, we made the mistake of trying to pull him into our world. We were so, it's almost like personal that we couldn't get our child to pay attention to what we were trying to get them to pay attention to. And I think a real aha moment, or maybe not aha moment, but a realization over time, was the fact that a better strategy might have been trying to pay attention to what Jaden was paying attention to. And this is sort of my advice that I give. I get that question after I speak oftentimes. You know, I have a sibling with autism, or I have a friend whose son has autism, or something like that, some family connection or friend. And what do I do? And my advice all the time is, you know, try to understand what they're paying attention to. Try to get a little bit into their world. Get yourself down to a level where your eyes are looking at the same thing from their level and their perspective. Mm-hmm. And be interested in what they're playing with and how they're playing with it, and try to play with them in that way. Interestingly, as I've taken that approach with Jaden over time, or anyone else that I'm interacting with on the autism spectrum, I'm also learning how to deal with people just generally, because there's a power to trying to understand someone else's perspective, mm-hmm. even if we don't fully understand it, right?
That seems like a kind of monumental approach. I mean, just beyond, you know, dealing with a person with special needs and autism, but even politics itself at some level, trying to really get to know what people are thinking and feeling, experiencing, and just how much there is this commonality to say, oh, I'm going to do this, please follow me, and how much energy has been put towards that. But this approach really seems like there's a bigger message here.
Well, the world we're in right now, politically, and not just politically in terms of politicians, politically in terms of people and the way we communicate with each other, is not healthy, quite mm-hmm. frankly. I'll say it's not healthy. It's not good for democracy. It's not good for human relationships. As I heard one commentator say in a podcast, you know, everybody, regular people, come to every conversation with talking points now. It's not just politicians on interviews, people in their interactions on social media, people even in their conversations. It's like they have talking points and they're just reading out their talking points, and then the other person's reading out their talking points, but no one's open to being persuaded, and no one's trying to persuade anybody of anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that act of persuasion or being persuaded is an important part of moving forward and communicating as people. And you may come across folks that you interact with where you feel like you're probably not likely to be persuaded. You might be fairly set in your ways of understanding. But one of the things that I've tried to do, and I think part of this is shaped by my interactions with Jaden, is to try and at least understand why someone is coming to the position they're coming from.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. rather than try and this goes beyond even the persuasion, rather than trying to bring my talking points and bombard them with it, maybe in a hope to persuade them, at least try and understand why they believe what they believe.
That's fantastic. And, you know, I might want to just go back and ask you a bit about some of your past political work that relates to some, you know, health issues and global health issues. But one of the things that, you talked about as well is this idea of inclusive education,
right? Yeah.
Globally inclusive education. You have taken your story with Jaden and your work with autism abroad. What does that look like?
So back in 2010, I had, you know, I was parliamentary secretary to the industry minister at the time. We were in government. It was 4 years into my time as a member of parliament, and had started to do some work on autism, and just mainly autism, actually. I hadn't really even broadened it to developmental disability. And I got asked, because I was doing some communications work with our party at the time, sitting on panels and things like that, got asked to go on a few panels to debate, to talk about our international development policy centered around the Muskoka initiative when we hosted the G8. So we hosted the G8 in 2010. Our signature initiative under Stephen Harper was the Muskoka initiative, which addressed health needs of, you know, what they called MNCH, maternal, newborn, and child health. So saving the lives of kids under five and saving the lives of moms in and around childbirth. So two of the Millennium Development Goals that we were behind in, the international development community rallied. We made it a signature initiative, and we had huge success in that in the long term. Looking back now, 14 years later, it's something that Canada was well regarded for. So that was my intro into international development. And so worked on this maternal, newborn, child health stuff. But as I started working on that, of course, as you're dealing with the, you know, making sure that kids are healthy, a part of that is getting out there with community health workers in many of these places and assessing kids' health. You know, there's a natural transition to making sure kids are in school. Mm-hmm. And I started also working with, you know, on the other side, working with organizations like Inclusion International and Special Olympics and Humanity and Inclusion, as they're now known, and other organizations. And gradually over time, started to kind of see a potential merging, a potential opportunity. There were some kids that were completely left behind.
Yeah.
And in the international development community, we talk about, you know, reaching the furthest behind or those kind of things. And the people who were the furthest behind consistently were people with intellectual developmental disabilities, oftentimes hidden away, mm-hmm. A lot of stigma attached to it. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes the explanation within communities would be a curse on the family of some sort. The common story in multiple places in the world that would be the way of thinking. And so this massive population of kids completely excluded from the education system. And so we look at Jaden's situation and the benefits of inclusion, not only on him, but on his school community, mm-hmm. right? Of course, we worked at including Jaden because we thought it would be best for his trajectory. But if you talk to the kids he went to school with, invariably, they would say that their life was better off for having Jaden included in their classroom.
Yeah.
It broadened their perspective, made them more aware of the full range of neurodiversity and all of those different things. In vast swaths of the world, we see tens of millions of kids not included in education systems. And so with this opportunity, I had a private member's bill slot come up this last year and had an opportunity to choose anything I want. And in a world where we're trying to, you know, you can use those opportunities to maybe make a political point, and sometimes that's really important. Mm-hmm. But we have lots of avenues to make political points. Mm-hmm. We also have that opportunity, if you want to try and build a consensus around something. And so I decided, given that sort of momentum that we had over years, successive governments on the health of kids, successive governments on education at a global level. And we moved a motion that says where the Canadian government spends money on education domestically or internationally, clear consideration must be given to the maximum inclusion of people with disabilities, including people with intellectual developmental disabilities. And there are a few key points worth making in that motion. So that was the motion. A motion is non-binding, so it's not a law. It mm-hmm. just says, here's an idea. Do you agree with it or not? But it forces everybody to vote on that thing. So we vote passed it unanimously, this motion. Everybody in the House of Commons voted for this motion. Now it gives us the opportunity to point to that vote, to everyone's vote, and say, okay, now we got to act on this. Mm-hmm. But the key points in there are, we say domestically and internationally, because the federal government, though education is provincial jurisdiction, does spend some money on education through transfers in Indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. There are places where the federal government spends money. But internationally, the federal government had just spent, I think, $85 million on replenishment for Education Cannot Wait, which funds education in emergency contexts, right?
Right.
War zones, refugee camps, those kind of things. We invest in the Global Partnership for Education. There are a lot of specific funding around girls' education and those kind of things, really important investments. And what we're saying is, when we make those investments, clear consideration must be given to maximum inclusion. So people have different ideas on what inclusion looks like. And we're saying, whatever you think of inclusion, let's push the envelope towards maximizing that inclusion. Mm-hmm. So in some places it might be a autism school somewhere, and that might be what they've, you know, they've started moving in that direction. Well, we'd like to see ultimately, if we can move towards getting kids involved in a regular school system, let's work towards what that maximum inclusion might look like. And then we single out, we say disabilities, including intellectual and developmental disabilities. It's very specific because oftentimes disability inclusive education winds up still excluding the kids with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So mm-hmm. inclusive education might involve building ramps or, you know, other accessibility things, Braille, some things that are fairly straightforward interventions or helps. But kid with autism or Down syndrome or cerebral palsy might be left out of that equation in terms of the inclusion aspect of it. So we want to make sure that no kids are excluded. So we say disabilities because we want to make sure that all of those things are included, but we want to make sure that we're not leaving anybody behind in that.
And there's so much context for that to go in the other direction. Like I said, with you, there's conflicts, there's cases where, you know, you still got a certain percentage of school age girls who are not in school mm-hmm. in key countries. And then, you know, there's so much. I remember working on a couple projects in India where it was very quick that stigma could follow someone based on a health issue, right? Mental, physical, otherwise. And that was it. I mean, the consequences that could follow that family could get severe very, very quickly, not just in terms of sort of the oral shunning, but actually escalating into physical violence at times, mm-hmm. right? It's also refreshing to hear because, you know, there's global health textbooks like Donde No Hay Doctor, where there is no doctor. It was a field guide by David Warner, who basically said, we got to get through some of the basics of stigma breaking and create inclusion and help people at community levels teach each other how to sort of be the custodians for each other's health. And so in many ways, it seems like such an innovative approach today actually goes back to some of the older methods of the past.
Absolutely. And the thing about it is you can really create a positive cycle, right? So if you think about it, if you can address stigma, you make it more likely that kids are going to get in school. But if you get more kids included in school, then you reduce stigma, right? So you build this positive cycle. And mm-hmm. the key to that approach is breaking out of the negative cycle we're in. So, you know, let's work to get kids in school. And at the same time, let's work to reduce stigma. And I think what we're finding is that there's a coalition of organizations. Almost anybody we talk to now is absolutely willing to play a part in this. So, you know, you reach out to education organizations like the Global Partnership or like Education Cannot Wait. Yasmin Sharif, the head of Education Yep. Cannot Wait, is a huge supporter of the efforts we're making. And of course, Special Olympics and Inclusion International and Humanity and Inclusion, they're big supporters of this. But, you know, you get your sort of mainstream big international development organizations like PLAN and World Vision, Save the Children, UNICEF is very involved. Anyone we talk to is willing to get engaged in this because they see the benefit. They've all signed on to the Sustainable Development Goals, sure. which talk about no one left behind, right? So it's just a matter of sort of creating some momentum and action, not this cycle of never-ending meetings talking about how big the problem is.
That's right.
But how are we going to drive action? And we're at a point right now where we've got, you know, people like Tim Shriver at Special Olympics, who is just a passionate advocate for action, mm-hmm. for meaningful action. And Robert Jenkins, a Canadian at UNICEF, who is the head of education, who is just incredibly impatient in the best of ways around driving action. And so this is the conversation that we're having right now. And if we can use this motion as a driver towards that, you know, building the sort of moral argument, I guess, for it in a sense, right? We're at a place where there's this opportunity to drive incremental action.
And I think what I really like about this approach that you put up in this bill about trying to, you know, put inclusion right at the forefront of it is that so often within international development, we'll have our benchmarks, we'll have our goals, up they go. And then there's the sub goals underneath it, right? We see how that kind of trickles down. Well, here's what we need to do for grade 7 girls, grade 7 boys. What's the literacy rate? What's the math score? What's all of these scores and benchmarks? We see how people hit them, tick the box, and does it get approved or not? But what you're kind of asking for, and to be inclusive, you know, bring people almost together in a way how you were listening to Jaden, right? Sort of seeing like what does he need? What is he experiencing? Right. Yeah. I'm hoping that there'd be the space so that that sort of inclusive education encourages more of that wherever it is in the world. If it's going to be in Kenya, if it's going to be in India, that those benchmarks for success also offer time so that people, classrooms, teachers themselves are able to learn from people who've got disabilities.
Oh, absolutely. If you're going to get this right, you have to include the voices of the people with disabilities, developmental disabilities, autism themselves in situations like with Jaden. You have to include families because it's challenging. I'm trying to constantly understand what Jaden's saying, but you know, and for him to have his voice heard, I'm a pretty important tool for him in a sense, right? Conduit for his voice to be heard. And so that's critically important. The other thing is that we need to take a look in addition to the benchmarks and the, you know, 1 year and 5 year and 10 year goals. What we're really trying to do right now is if I'm having a conversation with an education minister anywhere in the world, I want to give them something that they can do right now.
Yeah.
We need to have 1 week, 1 month targets. What is an actionable step that someone can take right now to get to further inclusion in their education system? And we want to come up with those sort of short-term measurables. I'm a big fan of what I would call rapid incrementalism. So small steps, but many of them taken so that you can take one now and take one next week and take one next week. And every day, every week, you're getting better and better in terms of what the evidence shows, on inclusion in your country. So the more steps we can take quicker that are positive, the more impact we're going to have in the short term.
Awesome. So I want to just ask you one last question here, the tough one. As a politician, you know, if you have a message to your constituents, to voters, if it's an election cycle or not, why should people in Canada care about these issues, especially those that are happening abroad?
Well, first of all, I think that if we're not having an impact or having influence, as Canada is not having an influence in some of these countries, then I guarantee you the Chinese government and the Russian government, they will be having an influence in these countries. And if you're talking about the education system and you think about the ripple effects of who's having influence in those systems, I think that that's something important to understand. I mean, we are an increasingly global connected world. Yeah. And I think that that's something that when people think of it in those terms, I think that that's important. Also, the fact that the populations we're talking about are among the most vulnerable, among the most marginalized in the world. And I think that these are steps. One of the reasons that the Muskoka Initiative was so successful is because it was such a clear need. There was such a clear opportunity for impact, for a positive outcome. And it was something that was almost impossible for anyone to disagree with.
Yeah.
You know, there aren't very many people who are anti-maternal health. You know, when you explain to people that kids were dying from diarrhea, right? Things that we would never accept in Canada, or that you could save the life of a woman giving birth by giving a 10-cent plastic sheet to put on the dirt floor when she was giving birth, and that might save her life. those were simple interventions that people could understand and would be supportive of. And I think that this is an opportunity that we have with inclusive education. People understand the importance of education. They understand that it is not okay for any 6, 7, 8-year-old not to be in school. And I think that it is a very small part that that Canada can play, mm-hmm. that the world can play in helping move the ball forward. And so I do think that when people kind of understand this and take, you have that short opportunity to articulate these things, I think that there's a broad consensus in Canada. And that's why this conversations like this are so important.
I hope so, because you're quite right. There's other development models in other countries and who seek themselves to be powers that are full of moral paucity, I guess we could say. So to see the value of commitments to these issues is important. It's what the country's about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Well, Mike, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come to Dalhousie to join us on Global Development Primer, and hope you enjoy the rest of your stay in Nova Scotia. And thanks so much for joining us today.
It was great. Enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.